Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to BAFTA-nominated composer Anthony Willis about his work on Saltburn.
The second I saw this film a few months ago, I was like, I have to talk to this man because I just was absolutely blown away by everything that took place during the film. So I'm just so happy I get to chat with you.
Thank you so much for being interested in the film and supporting. Yeah, it's a really fun moment when it comes out, you know, and you get the. You get the reactions. That's what Emerald's there for. She wants to stir the pot, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially after Promising Young Woman, I was like, well, where can she go next? And then you kind of get the synopsis of this one a few years ago, and it's like, oh, okay. And then it just completely goes in a direction I never expected.
Totally. Yeah. No. I think she's very clever with this movie. Like. Taking people by surprise, going like, oh, okay, I wouldn't have expected that, but like, it's way more imaginative that she's made this kind of movie, I think.
Mm. And so where did you two first sort of link up?
I knew Emerald not well at all, but we'd met a few times at some events in LA and I ran into her and she said, I've just finished my film and I'd love some advice on composers. And she knew that I'd been working for quite some time on like a lot of really quite traditional sort of movie scores, you know, for family movies and animation and doing additional music. And I think she was just curious at what somebody like me would bring to her films rather than, you know, going straight for a really modern sound designing score. I think she's like the coolest person you'll ever meet and also kind of has an old soul. So she really likes the kind of the history of film music and the tradition of having themes and having music that has a narrative meaning. And so I wrote a demo for her, and really just as a sort of look, in case you're curious what this experiment of Anthony doing your film might be like, here's some music that this is just how I see it. And I'd done very little films like Promising Young Woman. I mean, there was nothing, I don't think there is a film like Promising Young Woman, but I'd really just to see if it would help, really. It was like, hey, this is a perspective on your movie. And she really liked it. And so she brought me on and we did the film. And then the film was obviously really well received and deservedly so. And the score was well received as well. And so, you know, I think maybe 6 months after it had come out, she, you know, certainly deserved more of a break than that. But she was like, I'm writing my new script and I'm listening to the Promising Young Woman score and I can't wait to hear what you're going to do with this one. So, mm-hmm. I mean, she's just such a fun filmmaker and she's so detailed and she just makes the atmosphere really fun. And she's so imaginative and she's like got a great musical taste herself. She really loves music of all shapes and sizes. So, it's hard working with a filmmaker like Emerald because there's so few like her. So, you know, but I absolutely loved doing Promising and I love doing Saltburn.
Mm. Curious, what was your perspective on Promising Young Woman first when just sort of first introduced to you? And then what was your perspective also then on Saltburn?
Well, I think what I and I think everyone who's a fan of Emerald quickly realized about her films is that she has such a such an amazing way at showing us things in films that we just haven't, nobody's dared to put in a film before, or nobody's quite prioritized putting in a film before. You know, it's like almost the hidden camera. I mean, Promising Young Woman was the hidden camera. It's like, you know, if you put the camera in a certain place and you put the right music up and everything's all like rosy, the guy thinks that he's like had a great night, and he's talking himself into the fact that he's like, you know, made out with somebody or more, and he's had a great night. But Emerald shows us the camera from like where it really is, and like just the awkwardness of those kind of situations. And I think that's something obviously that's also consistent with Saltburn, that she shows us things for different reasons. She shows us things that we don't normally see, the side of people that they normally like don't necessarily want to show. And I think that's what makes her such one of the many things that makes her such an interesting filmmaker. So you know, specifically with the Promising Young Woman score, I mean, there were many things we were trying to accomplish with it, but also kind of ground the movie a little bit and give the character Nina, who isn't present in the film, more of a voice. You know, the ghost of Nina kind of hung like a vapor over the film. That was what we were trying to do with the score. And then Saltburn, there's kind of there's the opulence, there's the world of status and you know, Saltburn itself that represents this thing that's kind of happened for a long time. And I think things that traditions, humans use tradition to enforce a lack of change. They actually use it retroactively. They say, look, this is how things are always done, and this is how they're always going to be done. And it makes it hard to challenge them. And I think that's sort of what Saltburn is. It's like, you know, we're rich, you're not. And this is our house, and this is how we live. And Oliver's obviously desperately trying to fit into that and be accepted in that world. And so then that also opens up this chance to, you know, have scenes where people are actually on their own, and it's like, well, how they really want to behave. You know, they start to show what they actually really want to do, juxtaposed against this kind of rigid tradition of this is the etiquette of how things should be. So, you know, musically that was a thing too for Saltburn. It was, you know, there's a smartness and a poshness to the arpeggios, and actually a slightly intimidating awe to some of the Saltburn score as Oliver's approaching the house, that is kind of it's inviting but not. And then, you know, then there's the kind of more, a lot of the sex scenes are kind of taking instruments out of their normal ranges and having them be kind of really primal, and taking romantic string chords and ascribing them to much more kind of visceral textures, so that it's just a different it's just a different thing.
And I mean, there are so many interesting and so many different characters that we get to meet along the way in this once we sort of make it to Saltburn. And I'm just curious what it was like sort of combining sort of not different themes, but different, I mean, the different characters throughout this sort of, I guess maybe second part of the film, and sort of combining that world of where we've just left university, now we've entered Saltburn, and now we're sort of combining a bunch of different individuals sort of in this world, and also trying to give them their own sort of maybe not new unique sound, but a sound that's one of their own, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, really, the whole score is, it's basically managing what we as the audience are thinking Oliver is experiencing at any given time. And so it's all about his journey and his kind of fantasy of what this experience is like. And so The sound of Saltburn, as I was saying, is kind of gothic, but also Saltburn, fitting in at Saltburn also means, being accepted by Felix. And so there's a kind of romanticism to it as well. And they're kind of, Emerald always sort of said, those are one and the same, they're kind of intertwined. Felix, Saltburn, Felix is Saltburn. So when Felix is giving the tour around the house, it had to be warm and but still classical for Saltburn, but kind of warm and romantic and optimistic and sort of soothing. And I do it as a kind of waltz, a kind of more contemporary waltz. But for Felix, Emerald also really liked the idea of like a Wurlitzer piano. There's a lot of organ in the score, so we were like, well, what kind of modern organ could we use for Felix? And actually, like, what's a cool one? And it was a Wurlitzer. And that plays a part that kind of underpins the tour, and it appears in sort of other cues as well with Felix. So that was kind of his special color, and also he had like a slightly more contemporary organ in like Felix and Mika that pops up, and then then Venetia actually probably has the like slightly the dirtiest music in that, like, she has a lot of like low primal harp and the kind of saltpontoncello strings and these kind of romantic string chords. So that was a place that really opened that up, and that was fun for her stuff, because in a way Venetia's such a ultimately proves to be, in a way, the most fragile character. And so her music needed that kind of that delicacy, but also that kind of unbridled, a primal nature. And then obviously, yeah. So yes, the music kind of evolve, has to support the characters themselves, but it also is evolving with the shape of Oliver's experience. So it starts out very lonely. Well, it starts out very aspirational and gothic and romantic, and then it's very lonely when he's at Oxford and he doesn't really have any friends, and apart from Michael Gavey, the math genius, and then then it has to become kind of more of a friendship montage. So it's kind of constantly evolving with Oliver, and then he gets, having sort of thinking he's in with Felix, he then kind of realizes what life without Felix is like when he's what he's stalking Annabelle and Felix. So, that was what introduced the kind of more lustful music that then comes back in the shared bathroom when he's looking at Felix in the bathroom, and also when once he's kind of taking control with Venetia, then I use that again. So that thread kind of, it starts with him feeling completely out of control, meaning he's left out, he's lonely. Then it's used again in the bathroom, where he's sort of start, he's still left out, but then he kind of takes control of that piece of music, which is quite an interesting way of using a recurring piece. It's sort of, it has a different feeling each time, and it gets, each time it's played, it's slightly lower, it gets broodier and darker, more gothic, and that's sort of, that's a moment in the movie that reaches more of a kind of vampire gothic feeling, the for reasons that the where the blood, the blood comes from an unusual place in that scene with Venetia. So yeah, it was more about the shape overall of the story than really necessarily specifically prescribing things to characters, but sort of depended on where they fit into that shape. And then obviously ultimately then there's a kind of a mournful hymn like feel when Oliver's walking through the house after the morning after the party. So yeah, lots of different kind of flavors to explore, which is really fun.
And obviously the two films couldn't be any more different in terms of just the stories. But do you see Saltburn and Promising Young Woman in the same universe?
I don't think they're in the same universe, no. I think that they're very distinct films, and I think stylistically what Emerald was doing with both of them is very different. But I do think that she has such an original way of looking at things and approaching things that I think that really comes out in both. Her voice, I think, absolutely is clear in both films, to me, very clear to me in both. But I think that the movies themselves, very distinct from one another.
Yeah, I know. I was just curious if you ever sort of saw like a through line just in terms of going from one world to the next.
I don't think narratively there's a through line. I don't think the characters share. I don't think there's any shared characterization. And I also think that I think the protagonists are very different. I think that what Oliver's been through and is trying to achieve, and what Cassie are trying to achieve, I think are very different. But I don't know. What do you think? Maybe you detected things that I didn't.
No, I there's just the lonely sort of quality and the sort of, I don't know, the not that Oliver's trying to get revenge, but I don't know. I saw this just sort of I saw this lonely sort of creeping quality that, I mean, just makes its way towards the, I don't know, and maybe I'm totally off the mark there, but I see. And yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm totally off, but the two protagonists to me, they're, it kind of, I don't know, I see small bits and pieces in between the two. So I was just curious if there was anything that you were able to just grab from those two. But
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, obviously, like, Emerald's voice, and you're right, they both have like a strong, very strong lead protagonist who is conflicted. And there isn't a revenge element to both films. I agree with that. So yeah, I think Oliver's revenge is very complex. It's a very different kind than Cassie's. Which Oliver's sort of an opportunist. He's constantly, I think he makes smart decisions about things and lets them puts them into play, and then he kind of sees what happens next. He's a really like amazing opportunist. He's constantly like, one of my favorite bits of the film, and one of my favorite bits reading the script. There's a couple of obviously amazing shocks, and what my favorite one, just because it's the last one, is well, unless you count the dance through the house at the end, is the bike pop, because it indicates that he was constantly improvising right from the get-go, and making opportunities for himself, and that's really interesting. But you're right, and in that actually both characters are very clever, and they both figure out, a plan that's a fun reveal for the audience.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there were, I it just seems like they knew exactly what they wanted to do from the get-go, whether or not they, obviously their twists and turns went different ways, but anyway, I was curious there. But what was the unique challenge for you on this film in comparison to past ones?
Sorry, say one more time.
What was the unique challenge in creating the score for this film in comparison to past ones?
Yeah, I mean, every film feels like a challenge, certainly when you set out, because it generally, and I think it should feel, if you're trying to do something different and new, or the film is, you don't know what to do, you don't know quite how to go about it yet. And it was I think, what I was describing about managing Oliver's journey, that was challenging. And it was what made it really fun too, but it was kind of, we wanted this feeling that when you get to the end of the movie, it was all kind of, the breadcrumbs are all there, and everything was kind of hidden in plain sight all along, rather than getting to the end of the movie and going, oh, well, that's cheating. That's just, you just, turned a massive corner. I think what's satisfying is the payoff of, oh, okay, I didn't quite see it going that way, but it was there. It was right under your nose. So that with the score was fun to do, kind of basically hiding Oliver's motivations in the music. So it's the same kind of the same theme that I have for him is there. It's just done in a really lonely way. And then when you get to the end of the film, it's done with a huge amount of bravado and panache and you know, as if he was pulling the strings with ease. So that was really the kind of that I saw as my most important assignment. The other important assignment, of course, was to really lean into the romance between Oliver and Felix and really, you know, push this fantasy that they're having together. So yeah, it was, you know, it's there's just so many ways of doing these things, and you just chip away to find one, you know, together. Emerald and I kind of, you know, I'd write something and she'd go, oh, what if it was more or less, or you know, kind of pushing and pulling it in different directions, seeing how extreme it could be. I mean, there was one, the scene, the morning after scene when he's walking through the house, that was a really important one tonally for Emerald, because I think she wanted it to, in a way, encapsulate a lot of the feeling of the movie. And initially we did it as like a really intense horror, kind of broody, you know, really yeah, more visceral. And actually then Emerald, I think, realized she just wanted a hint of that kind of timbre, but she wanted emotionally it to be a bit more sincere and like a really mournful piece.
And I mean, what do you take away just from, I mean, the reactions that the film has had in terms of as it's had its rollout?
Oh, I mean, I think the reactions have been in many ways like even better than one would anticipate. I mean, I remember seeing it. I can't remember what I texted Emerald after she first screened it for us. It was, you know, wicked and diabolical and in all the best ways. I think I said something like that. But people are having that reaction on a huge level. They're really feeling just like, I think basically everyone who sees the movie needs like a minute. And it's been funny, I've done some Q&As and I feel bad for, you know, after screenings, and I feel bad for all the people in there, because what they really need is just to go and walk outside and like, you know, look at the like Coke machine outside, just to be like, oh my God, okay, everything's okay. I'm not, you know, it's death. And that's amazing. Like, that's an amazing feeling to get an audience to feel something, because we're so consumed with content now. Like, I think it's hard for a filmmaker to shock an audience. We're so blasé. So I think that's really cool to see that reaction. Like, and definitely I know, like on TikTok, the kind of before and after has been a big thing. People blowing up, you know, back and forward about that. So that's yeah, I really that's really fun. And of course then there's people that don't like the movie, and I think, you know, certainly more conservative audiences, it's not so much their thing. And I think Emerald knows that. I mean, she writes for that. She thinks she's enticed by that challenge of actually almost upsetting people with the truths that she wants to share. So yeah, you know, obviously it's not gonna get like a universal thumbs up the way a film like Barbie does. But it's really fun to see the reaction.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting, sort of just being able to walk out of the screening room and not really having anyone talk to about it for a while, and then all of a sudden you kind of are getting so many different opinions on every little moment in the film, which is just, I don't know, I think it's extremely fun, and like you said, there's so much content being thrown out there that it's just interesting to be able to actually continue to consume something and to continue to have the dialogue with something instead of just throwing it to the side and saying like, oh, okay, well, this was what it was. But no, I mean, I'm still thinking about it, like I said earlier, many months later, which
Which
is so
is,
hard.
that's the, yeah, obviously you don't want to be thinking about it because you go, I just wish I could have those 2 hours of my life back. It's not that. I think people have really, it like hits you right here. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So Yeah, no, I feel so fortunate to be attached to it and to have been a part of it, and really so grateful that, so many people have really enjoyed the score and reached out to me, and that's, it's we really try our best, but you just don't know how people are going to take things. So yeah, really, really wonderful moment for sure.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery. But a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.